Roundtable Osteuropa. Ein Podcast des Zentrums für Osteuropa und internationale Studien. Hello and welcome back to the ZEUS Podcast Roundtable Eastern Europe. My name is Stefanie Orfel and I will be your host today for this special episode where we bring you news from the Ukraine Research Network at ZEUS. The Ukraine Research Network is a networking and transfer project funded by the German Federal Ministry of Education, and it was launched last year, November 2020, as a reaction to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. A reaction on the academic, on the research sector to strengthen social science research on Ukraine, strengthen its visibility and its impact and also its networks. And as a part of this project, ZEUS hosts residential and non-residential fellows. So there are two fellows, Ukrainian researchers who come to Berlin, as well as providing support for non-residential fellows who work from Ukraine and conduct their research there. And today we are lucky to have two of our Ukraine-based fellows here in person. Welcome Natalia Zaika and welcome Anastasia Shurenkova. Glad to have you here with us. As I said, you are working, you're based in Ukraine, working in your projects from there. And I want to ask you a few questions, of course, about your work, but I'm also very interested in your academic backgrounds, as I read that you are both from very different fields, and I really would like to learn about that. So, Natalia, you studied philology, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And Anastasia, you're a mathematician by your
yes,
degree.
Yes, math and marketing.
That's very interesting. So can you tell me, since the unit program is about social sciences, exactly how you came from your field to what you're doing now? Natalia, would you start?
Yeah, thanks a lot. I got a bachelor degree in philology at Kyiv Mohyla Academy in Kyiv, one of the best universities in Ukraine. And then I got a master's degree in journalism, again at Kyiv Mohyla Academy. So this was more a humanitarian field. And then I was working for more than 10 years at the university called Kyiv School of Economics as an educational administrator. So I do some administrator jobs with working with students and professors there. And this academic environment inspired me to study further. And I finished some courses there at Kyiv School of Economics on behavioral economics, on data analysis, on statistics and econometrics. So I didn't get a formal degree there, but I got I took a set of courses there that gave me some knowledge and understanding of economics and data analysis. And that's how I came to the behavioral economics field. It was more like a self-education. I read some books and took some online courses on that. And I started developing myself in behavioral economics. I like it a lot. And starting from the last year, I am working at the Institute for Behavioral Studies at American University, Kyiv.
Thank you. And we will learn more about what behavioral studies or behavioral economics actually does.
Okay.
How about you, Anastasia?
I graduated Kyiv Polytechnical Institute as a Magister of Applied Mathematics, and the next year as a Magister in Marketing. It was simultaneously, two courses simultaneously, and then I worked a couple of years as a journalist, and then one of my friends from journalist field started to work in GfK, is a big marketing company that had branch in Ukraine, and I just thought, wow, this the work I always wanted to do. So I started to work in GfK in 2004, And first I worked in B2B studies as a marketing specialist and then shift to sociological area. So I have a lot of interest in business studies and in sociological studies as well.
That's very interesting. I think it brings you also already to your project you are working on at the moment. Can you tell us a little bit about the topic you are dealing with now?
Yes, now I'm dealing with a topic that called as the state of Ukrainian business and its readiness to recover in and to take part in recovering processes in Ukraine after the victory, I hope. So I believe that business is a very important part of the society, and these people who run their own business and or who heads of businesses, they are the most active part of society as a people. So it's very important to understand how they feel and how to support them. And the second point is that the state of business affect directly at the state of people, because the state of business it means there are a lot of good payable jobs mm-hmm. for people and the better states of economics in general and so on. Mm-hmm. So
And how do you collect data for this, or what kind of data are you working with? Is it surveys, or do you get data directly from the...
Now I'm working in line of surveys that was done and is doing now in Ukraine, because some, not a lot, but some organization continue to conduct regular surveys of business. And this data is open, so I can gather it together and analyze it and see the similarities and differences in this data. And the main goal of my study is to bring it together and make the general scope of the state of business. It's a lot of challenges on this way, but in fact, I think it would be interesting.
Mm. That's the challenges was something I wanted to ask you about, especially in times of war. I imagine there's a lot of uncertainty in this area. So, how do you deal with that, especially in the economic sector that we are talking about now? How can you make predictions, and how do you analyze that?
Oh, fortunately, I don't make predictions. But in fact, the data I work with is based on the direct survey of businesses in Ukraine that was conducted by telephone or by online forms, something like this. So I'm working with the direct answers with business representatives. Mm-hmm. And from this point of view, how to serve businesses or people in Ukraine, yes, we have a lot of challenges, but in fact, we still can do this job. We and other Pol organization, Pol institution in Ukraine, we will still survey people, because as we see, the response rate became even higher than it was before the war, that it seems like people want to talk about the most important topic, even with interviewers.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, maybe we can get back to this topic later on. Natalia, what about you? You're working in the field of behavioral studies in the Institute for it at American University Kyiv, as you said. Can you explain, if possible, in a few words, what it behavioral studies is and how it works?
Sure. Behavioral economics is the field with the main question how people make decision under risk and uncertainty. So probably it's all the time we have to make decisions when we do not have the whole possible information. In real life, it's just impossible to have the whole information. So we also always have some assumptions, or we call it shortcuts, you know, how to make some decisions. It comes from the very small decisions on what to buy in the supermarket, for example. to some high-level decisions. Should I marry or not? Which university to choose? Should I stay in the country at war or should I evacuate? So very different set of decisions. We studied that and we tried to find the factors that influence these decisions from one side. On the other hand, we try to explore some very topics that are very typical for behavioral economics, like risk perception. Do people want to take risks or do they avoid risks, and what influence those? Under different circumstances, people might change. For example, I don't like risks. I don't play at casino, for example. But under some circumstances, I may change this. Or the issues of trust. Whom do we trust, like the president, the army, people around us, or other things, or other people? And these issues of trust influence our decisions again, because if I trust people around, I am more calm, I am more confident, I may make some decisions. For example, people who trust banking system, they go and put their money on deposits, right? And people who do not trust, they do not do that. People who do not trust their politicians, they behave in a certain way. The issue of social norms we also discover. That means how not the official rules, not official laws, but the social norms in your group, in your society, influence your decision. For example, one of the topics we are working on is the willingness to seek mental help during the war. In Ukraine, it is not very socially acceptable to go and to go to the therapist or psychologist and ask for mental health. So many people do not do that by themselves because of some stigma and social norms. They do not accept that. So you will be treated like, okay, are you crazy? Why do you do that? And so on and so forth. So the social norms have very huge impact on what we do. So maybe I want to do this, but I know that I will be socially punished for that, and I do not do that. So here are some set of topics, examples of topics we do in behavioral economics.
And it's very true, especially for men, if we can touch the gender aspect. For women, it's more acceptable, but for men, it's totally unacceptable by social point of view.
You mean mental health issues?
Yeah, mental health, yes. Okay. To seek help in mental issues.
Yes. And especially for militaries and veterans, they are supposed to be like strong men who doesn't need any help. But today, this is the group who probably need the most this mental help. And it is important to show them that it is okay to go and ask for mental help. It is okay to receive this help. You will feel better. Your family will be better and everything. So it is for behavioral economics, the topics that I mentioned, this is the first step. We discover that. But what is the most important is the next step. We try to suggest behavioral interventions to change the behavior to make it more socially acceptable and beneficial for the person.
That's what I was going to ask next. How are you finding out these things? So what methods are you working with before we maybe go to the next step? Is it also surveys or?
We typically have two main instruments. This is the surveys, of course. They give a lot of information. And the other one is the experiments, or we call it randomized controlled trials. This is similar to the medicine, might be more. Many people know about these experiments in medicine, like we have new pills, which we do it to one group and do not give it to another group, and then we compare if it works or not. We do something similar in behavioral studies. So if we, for example, want to evaluate if some interventions will work or not, let me give you some example. I think that if in the hospital where many people come for a regular checkups or whatever to for medical help, we will give them a booklet, a flyer with the information that they can also receive some mental help for free. So you can go there, this is the number of the room or the telephone number, whatever, and then they will go and do it. Because my assumption is that people do not seek mental help because they are not aware how to do that. Mm-hmm. Then I choose one hospital and I put these papers, these booklets with this information at the registration, for example, and they choose another similar hospital and I do not put this information there. And then after some time I compare if people from that hospital where I put this information, if more people went to the therapist in those hospital where I gave them this additional information.
Or just call a hotline, for example.
Yeah, or whatever is written on this booklet. Mm-hmm. So this is what we usually use in behavioral studies, these experiments we are trying to... So surveys is typically used to collect the data and to see what's going on, what people think about some issues. And when we want to try some interventions, we do these experiments and try.
Mm-hmm. So it's a complementary setup,
I would say.
Because we get to find out trust rates and so on, you would field a survey, and then to find out how that influences something else, you would go about doing that. You're currently studying war-related issues. You already gave some examples. You also studied how evacuation messages work, or is this something you are still working on? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, this is one of the topics I am working on for about a year already, and I continue with my team. We study the evacuation decisions during the war. So approximately last May, we met in a small group of behavioral scientists and we were talking about what's going on during the war. And we noticed that some people do not evacuate from a very dangerous zones where the threat is obvious and, you know, it's from the distance it looks very weird. Why don't you leave the city or the village where the bombs are falling on your head? Mm-hmm. And we were interested and we wanted to understand what drives their behavior, why they do not want to leave those dangerous zones. And again, the next steps, could we as scientists suggest something that could help to evacuate, to persuade more people to leave? What did we do? We did a survey. We polled people in 10 regions that were either directly affected by the war, they were under occupation, or their military actions were on those regions, or they were close to the borderline in Ukraine. So this is north, east, and south of Ukraine. We polled people there, and we asked whether they evacuated or not during the war. And we did it after 6 months after the war beginning. So there was 6 months that they made some decisions. In our sample, we had people who never left their cities. They stayed for all the time. We had people who evacuated and returned already, and people who evacuated and did not return yet. So we looked at all those people trying to understand what is different between these groups, why some made one decision and some others. What we found is obviously some demographic factors. Women with children were more likely to evacuate, which is naturally. People who have cars, who had cars. Cars is the best predictor of evacuation decision in our study. So as soon as the family had a car, they were more likely to evacuate. People with from large families were less likely to evacuate. So if you have many children or you have a huge family, like grandparents with you, whatever. So if there are many people in the household, they were more likely to stay in their houses. And what is, let me add something, it is very important to say for me, even though in academic world, when you do not find the connection between the factors, it means you do not have some results typically. But in this case, we didn't find that risk perception influenced the decision. And for me, it is a huge result because it means that all people who stayed in their homes very well understood how risky it is. Mm-hmm. We asked them, did you agree or disagree that there was a risk that you will be killed, that your house will be damaged, that you will be out of food, for example, some different risks. And we see that people who stayed evaluated all of these risks very high. For example, the risk of being killed, 90% of people who stayed in their homes and never left said that, yes, I agree, there was a risk for me. And nevertheless, they didn't want to leave. So it's not the risk perceptions that drive the decision to leave. and it goes to the next step, there is no sense for authorities to try to persuade people to leave because it is dangerous there. You don't need to tell it again and again, okay, please leave because you will be out of water, out of food, your house will be damaged. They know that very well. You cannot know that because you leave and you see all that. So this is not a way of good communication. You will not persuade people that way. But what we found through the experiment that we did is that giving people some sort of plan makes the difference. What I mean by plan is adding to this evacuation message a couple of sentences that you can go by bus from this point at that time, or you can call by this phone to sign up for evacuation. You will be taken to that particular place and you will be given that particular support, money support or whatever. So as soon as you not just try to motivate them because of some reasons and trying to suggest different reasons, you add this practical information to the message, the willingness to leave increases. So this is our main suggestion for the local authorities who are in charge of evacuation people, that you know, try to find to persuade people that it is needed to evacuate, but give them some practical information how to do that and what kind of help they will receive.
That's a very, very, very practical research outcome. So it's really impressive how quickly this translates to real life. I have been thinking in the beginning, before we had this conversation, how to connect maybe the two of you in terms of topics. And I was wondering, Natalia, you have been working on also decisions of refugees, and Anastasia, you are working on the Ukrainian economic enterprises. And this is something that's probably very connected, because of course the question whether refugees who left Ukraine decide to return or when and under what circumstances is very relevant for the Ukrainian economy and for the outlook. So what is the situation there? How much do we know? And also maybe how is the question addressed? I don't know who would like to start. Maybe you, Anastasia?
Thank you. I will try to start. The main question about refugees and EDP person in Ukraine is, do they want to go home back? So this is the main question of all studies. What can drive them to go home, and what can prevent them from this? And the state of economics is an important factor. And in fact, vice versa, the returning people home is a very important factor to develop economics. Because when there is no people, there is no market, there is no demand, and in fact, there are no business. And again, when people go home, the markets grow and demands grow and business develops. So it's very related topics, the return of refugees to Ukraine and development of Ukraine business. And again, it's the very important if refugees who came from Ukraine to Europe and other country, if they can have a work in Ukraine, way payable, of course it should be well payable work. Mm-hmm. So it's important for them, and it's important issues.
So on the one hand, perspective to find work is important for the decision. Yeah. To maybe go back, and on the other hand, it's also very important for how the economy will develop, what the outlook is. So it's a little bit a circle.
It's certainly a circle, and we should seek some ways to solve it properly. Mm-hmm. And because if people will not come, for whom we should recover Ukraine?
I may add here, on one of the conferences on rebuilding Ukraine, you know, there are a lot of them, the First Lady of Ukraine, Elena Zelenska, said, we should return, we should bring people home and they will rebuild everything. So when we start talking about rebuilding Ukraine, we should bring people home first, and this is the task for the
and
for
again
the
we should repeal to make them
yeah,
go
course.
Home. So
yes, if I may add to this topic, yes, we want to study the motivation to come back. We haven't collected our own data yet, so I can't share any results. But I'm following the news and the studies of other institutions. And from what I know is that, of course, for many people, the first step or the first signal that they may come back is the end of military actions. The security situation, that's naturally, this is what they care about first of all. But of course, we couldn't be naive. And if the war stops tomorrow, it doesn't mean that, well, there will be huge lines at the border and many people coming back. Of course not. And it is important to understand that, to understand the motivation of people to return or not, we should study carefully the situation inside Ukraine, like where they can come back. Do they have homes? Do they have jobs, as Anastasia said? Are they secure here? But on the other hand, we should take a look at what the situation is in their hosting countries now. Do they have jobs here? Do they have a good housing here? Do their children go to school here? How well are integrated already there? And what support they have here in hosting countries? And of course, most people will compare their prospects in a new country and in Ukraine. And many people, it depends on what they are offered here or what they already gain here in new countries and what they can gain again in Ukraine. And this comparison will be the main factor for making a decision. Should I stay or should I leave? Or should I stay in a new country or should I go back to Ukraine? But the war is interesting, let me say so cynically, from the academic perspective. Because from what I noticed in my studies and from all the information I receive around is that for many people, the factors for their decisions are not so much physical or tangible things, but intangible. Like, it's not only, do I have a house? Do I have walls around? Do I have a bed? But it's the feelings and emotions of being at home. And very often in many studies, we miss this. We never ask for that. We ask, do you have a job? Do you have a house? Do you have a car? Whatever. Do you go to school? But we miss these intangible things. But it's really what motivates people. It sounds weird for many people, especially from the field who study, like, I don't know, money and whatever physical world around us. But people say, I just want to go home no matter what. I want this feeling of home. I want to be in my city, in my home, in my bed. And the question of, will be my job highly paid or less paid in Ukraine, goes to the second place. For many economists, this is not typical. They say they believe that this should be the primary factors, but that's what we see, that being in your own environment is important. I may say my example, if I may. When the war started, I was living in Kyiv, and I left Kyiv on the very first day, on February 24th, with my family, and I went to Vinnytsia. This is a regional center in the center of Ukraine, to my mom's flat. So we were living there in good conditions. So this was the flat, three rooms, like we have enough space. I was with my mom, she helped me with some practical stuff like cooking or whatever. So everything was okay. But somewhere, it was the end of March, probably beginning of April, I start talking that I want to return home. Even though the safety in Vinnytsia was it was more safer to stay there than return to Kyiv, because obviously Kyiv was always and is still a main target for Russians. But I say, I want to sleep in my bed, I want to drink from my cup, I want to use my bathroom, whatever. So this is so irrational, but this is important. And now for many people who are abroad or who are internally displaced people in Ukraine, they want to return home because they just want this feeling. And this irrationality we also have to study, and we also had to include in our surveys, in our polls, to understand this motivation.
Yeah, this is the huge perspective for behavioral study. Exactly. I almost envy you.
Exactly. It's probably very very difficult to measure. Also, yeah.
Yes, it is difficult. Probably some people, agencies or institutions do not do that because this is so much difficult to measure comparing to the, you know, level of salary. Yes, this is the numbers. But still, I believe this is important. And if I may add, I mentioned the survey that we did last year. Was we tried to find the factors for evacuation decisions, and I believe we also miss this irrational or intangible things, because we asked about, did you have a transportation to leave, did you have money enough to leave, and whatever. But then when I deep into this topic more, and I saw many interviews, even on TV, in media, and reading some in-depth interviews with people, I understood that we should try to understand those irrational or emotional or intangible things that drive the decision. And we are now preparing for the next stage of this research, and we will try to include this, emotions, thoughts, try to find out this irrational, intangible things that are important for people's decision.
Yes, and I'd like to add that our latest study that will be presented next week proves what Natalia said, because we included this statement, I just want to be with my family, I just want to be home, for EDP, not for refugees, for EDP from Ukraine. And this factor was the most important in the list, and it was ranked much higher than the second important factor.
Thank you. And also thanks for sharing your story. We have talked about a lot now about your research, about war-related issues. I wanted to ask you about how researching in times of war works, because you're both living in Kyiv, you're both based in Kyiv right now. How is the war affecting the way you work or can work at the moment?
Okay, can I start? Okay. It's two sides of this question. The first is, of course, to have work is blessing. So you can distract from all this situation. You can run deep into my numbers and my data sets and my questionnaires and so on.
Escape from reality.
Yes, and escape this. So I have a lot of work now, and I'm grateful for this. It's much better than just laying under the blanket and crying, for example. But from the other hand, as my brain is my main tool in my work, I feel how I lost some concentration, and I'm very easy distracting from my work, from, for example, by news or so on. And it's challenging, because I need more time to concentrate. I need to write down every task, not to try remember, just write it down and then check if I made everything I planned. So it's other style of work, probably. Not such easy, not such smart as I used to be before the war, but just more. I feel that I should be more, probably more robotic. I need more support from, more technique support, probably from myself, but just to have a habit to write all my tasks, to check all my tasks, to check if I write this letter, if I send this letter, if I answer this question, to say to myself, please read it carefully and more carefully than you used to do it before. So this is some another style to work, but I hope that all who work in Ukraine, they manage to do this work properly. And we discussed with our colleagues in the office, it's the same issues we suffer from, but usually we somehow deal with it.
Mm-hmm. If I may add, from what I know from myself, from my colleagues and the people around, of course the most difficult and disruptive times were the beginning of the war, the first weeks, the first months, when the situation was so unstable and uncertainty, when no one knows what does it mean to live in a war, like you have never been prepared for that. And everyone was thinking, first of all, about the safety of yourself and of your family, of course. Then I would say when the Russian army went away from Kyiv region and from the north of Ukraine and the situation became more or less stable, the front line was not moving so fast, it became easier to plan anything, just to go again to this working rhythm. And then the next period that was very stressful and disruptive and was difficult to do anything was, of course, the end of autumn and winter, when we had heavy blackouts and heavy shellings all over Ukraine. It was very hard from the practical point of view to plan anything, because you don't have electricity for half of a day or whatever. In my house, the longest period when there was no electricity at all, it was 3 days in a row, almost 72 hours when we didn't have electricity in my flat. Even though then there appeared some schedules, you know, it was like these 2 hours you will have electricity, then four without, then two with, and so on and so forth. It became easier. You always compare to something before, and you're, okay, now we have schedules. It's much better than without, even though the schedule is like literally 2 hours with electricity, four without, two with, four without. So it's not like something very entertaining, but it's better than without. So anyway, what I try to say, that this period was really difficult for all people who are working and researchers as well, and of course all meetings, online meetings, they are always cancelled and rescheduled, because sometimes the electricity is out, even if it is supposed to be. This period was really tough for all of us, and then the spring came, it became, much better. Now we have the electricity all the time. But, of course, these air alarms are very disruptive factors. So as soon as the air alarm is on, you start monitoring the news, what's going on. Are the drones or missiles going to your city? Because we all have these Telegram channels where they say that, okay, the missiles were already launched, so it should reach Kyiv in an hour or in 2 hours. So we all have this information. And as for me, at that time, I just cannot concentrate on the work. I cannot do some intellectual work, because I'm monitoring the news and, trying to understand, is it really dangerous for me here? Is it not? Should I do something? I typically didn't do anything, but still, mentally you are thinking about this news. I thought about your job. So this is very disruptive, of course, and it is difficult to plan your day, because you have some tasks for your day as usual, but then the alarm is on and you have to take off the job and do something else. Or, for example, just from routine, from our daily routine, I'm planning to go to the supermarket, and then the air alarm is on and the supermarket is closed. I cannot do it right now. I have to change all my plans and, wait till it is open. Or my child is not going to school because the air alarm is on in the morning. Then I have to rearrange my day, because I was planning that he will be at school and I can work and he is not at school. So, of course, this everyday uncertainty is very difficult to deal with. Of course, all people who are in Ukraine manage to do it somehow. We more or less know that, okay, it is possible that something will happen. or during the May, the Kyiv was heavily attacked almost every night, and you know, you don't sleep enough at night, you wake up all the time. Of course, you cannot be productive during the day as much as you would like to. So this is, of course, the main factors during the war that prevent us from being productive, from doing our job well. And as for me, again, my personal examples, that, well, I cannot deliver some results on time when promised or when agreed. And this is one more next step of, stress, because I cannot do something as I planned, and then I feel like the people around expect me to do something by some time, you know, and I cannot do that. Of course, everyone understands, but, you know, it's inner feeling that I'm not doing right, I'm not doing well what I'm supposed to do. Yeah, this is the landscape.
The meeting deadline is the most challenging things. And feeling guilty because you cannot meet your deadlines, it's not pleasure feeling. Well, but I think that this war made us more flexible. So you cannot follow the sub plan. You can adjust your plans for the situation. And I know that some people went to the metro station during blackouts when electricity was always, and make calls and make online meetings from metro stations. And I myself went one time when I had an urgent meeting, and I cannot postpone or cancel it, so I went to metro and conduct my meeting from here.
Well, I don't think, yeah, well, you probably know it, but of course you should not feel guilty. I think it's impressive that you are keeping up this kind of work at all. I think thank you for sharing. It's very important to hear about this side of research, and not just to, you know, to get the results, and but to know how it has been created also. So thank you also for talking about your projects and explaining it so well. I really learned a lot today. Thank you again for coming, and to the listeners for listening and taking part, and talk to you at the next episode.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for listening.